On this seventh day of August 2011 in San Diego, we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th canto, 22nd chapter, Elements of Material Creation, text number 49.
What's 47?
He read that. But we'll, that's all right, it's a short purpose. We'll read right through it. We'll chant this verse. Eta monodotamayir.
Eta monodotamayir.
Anyasyo chavachastanu.
Anyasyo chavachastanu.
Gunasangarupadate.
Gunasangarupadate.
Kvachit kashchin jahati cha. Translation: although the material body is different from the self, because of the ignorance due to material association, one falsely identifies oneself with the superior and inferior bodily conditions. Sometimes a fortunate person is able to give up such mental concoction. Purport. One who has received the special mercy of the Supreme Lord is able to give up the mental concoction of bodily identification. Thus, there is always a chance of escaping the cycle of birth and death. I'll read the next verse. Atmanak pitraputa abhyam anumeyao bhavapyayam na bhavapyaya vastunam abhigyo dvayalakshanah. By the death of one's father or grandfather, one can surmise one's own death. And by the birth of one's son, one can understand the condition of one's own birth. A person who thus realistically understands the creation and destruction of material bodies is no longer subject to these dualities. Purport. The Lord has described the 9 stages of the material body, beginning with impregnation, gestation, and birth. One may argue that a living entity cannot remember his presence in the mother's womb, nor his birth and early infancy. The Lord therefore states here that one can experience these phases of bodily existence by studying one's own child. Similarly, although one may hope to live forever, by experiencing the death of one's father, grandfather, or great-grandfather, one has definite proof that the material body will die. A sober person, knowing the soul to be eternal, therefore gives up false identification with the temporary, unreliable body and takes shelter of the devotional service of the Lord. By this process, one can escape the artificial imposition of birth and death. Om Jnana Timarandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshu Unmilatam Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master Srila Prabhupada opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisance unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. So, Bhagavatam is a great class. It's a great class. It's an educational experience, and it's even in the form of a class. The book is being spoken by Shukadeva Goswami to Maharaj Pariksit, and they're all sitting there just like we're sitting here. And there are certain techniques of teaching. Teaching is an art, and it's a science. And one of the things that's necessary for a teacher to understand is just where his students are at. And there's no point in teaching, you know, a second grader, you know, sixth grade material. He hasn't prepared for that, right? You have to teach to the subject, otherwise it's not teaching. It's just showing off. So we find in the Bhagavatam so many instances in which Krishna is teaching, or the representatives of Krishna are teaching. And they're giving us so many useful analogies. Analogies are exactly intended for that. How can we understand, the vastness of Krishna? He's everywhere. God is everywhere. He's created everything. You know, well, we can't. But we can begin to at least think about vastness if you think about the ocean. That we can think about. We can walk down the street. You see? If you are the subject matter of epistemology, not understand, you know, not being able to, or not you know, exactly this point, trying to bring inconceivable matters or fantastically great matters within the purview of our understanding. You know, that's a theoretical concept, but it takes concrete form. You can understand it when you learn about the frog and the well. Does anyone know the analogy of the frog and the well? We'll go over it again because it's in the... So the frog in the well is very, very down home. You know, imagine right here near the ocean, because it goes to the ocean. So there's a well. It's a traditional well, you know, with a little fence and then there's a hole. And in that well, there's a little puddle of water or whatever, water's down there. And there's a little community of frogs there. And in any community, there's a leader. And so there was a senior frog, and he was known as Professor Frog. And he knew everything there was to know about that well. Little tadpoles would take place, take birth, and they would become little frogs, and they would learn from him the ins and outs of the well. So he was a little proud, because he was senior. So one day, a very athletic frog somehow jumped out of that well, and hop, 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 down to Beryl, down to Mission Boulevard, and then he got to the ocean, down there in the Pacific Ocean. What's this? There's water here, just like there's water in the well, but this is like inconceivably larger amount of water. Suddenly blew his mind, you know, that there could be that much water. Because he had never heard of such a thing. The limits he had known was just the well. So this was like a revelation to the frog that would escape. So he goes back, hop, 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 back to the well, jumps back inside, and breathlessly starts to try to tell Professor Frog about this whole new experience. But Professor Frog, although he knew everything there was to be about that well, he couldn't conceive of that much water. So he started to speculate. Oh, you've seen a large amount of water? Is it three times the amount of the water in this well? That he could probably conceive of, you know. And the young frog rolled his eyes a little bit. You don't understand. You know, okay, maybe 6 times, 10 times, 20 times. So all of that was clearly, completely foolish, right? And so the frog is described, you know, he's puffing himself up and he finally burst. He couldn't understand it. So that's a very kind of down-home analogy. You know, we even have illustrations and so forth. But it illustrates a very, very important point that knowledge of God, knowledge of these absolutes, knowledge of the material energy even, is beyond our scope to grasp with what we know. Even the greatest scientist, you know, after studying through the means of science, which is the what we call the ascending process, observation, hypothesis, testing, and then you come to what is called a theory. You know, they even call it a theory, which means that it could be revised later. But it's the strongest thing they've got. This is their theory, how the world works. This is their theory, how the universe came to be, the Big Bang theory. But now they're revising it. It's like we're working on a reprint of a magazine called Origins Magazine. You remember Origins? You remember Origins. Some, but many of you don't remember it. It was printed in 1984. We had a few reprints. And then it went out of print. It was a very nice thing. It was put together by Sada Buddha Babu, Judah Karma was involved, and our scientists. And it dealt with the Big Bang theory, the creation. It was called Origins, the origin of life, the origin of the universe, where we come from, you know. So we're redoing it. It's good. But now we had to add something. I mean, it's now 25 years later. They've come up with a little, you know, twist on the Big Bang theory. Don't ask me to explain it. It's called string theory. You know, it has to do with mathematics and this and that, you know. They try to adjust it because what they had wasn't describing what they could see anymore. They have these big colliders, you know, they break the atoms, and then there's some trail, and they make new conclusions. Oh, now we have a new particle. We've got to integrate it to our theory or whatever. So we had to add a section. Judah Karma wrote it, or had someone write it, and we put it in, you know. So this is the ascending process. And if we, you know, in the next 30 years, if they reprint Origins again, we'll probably add a few pages, a few more illustrations, you know. So the point I'm getting at is that repeatedly through the Bhagavatam, and also Bhagavad Gita, you know, Krishna, dehi no smriyata dehi, this is an analogy. You know, from where you're at, who can't understand, you know, that he or she was a child at one point. That we can understand, right? Okay, a child, and now you see, then, you know, adolescent, then adult, middle age, old age, death. It's not rocket science. That we can understand. So then the revelation comes. Can you see if the kitchen door can be closed? You can close it. Your mother has the operatic voice. You can hear all the way from me. And so then you just have to stretch a little bit. And just as you've been changing through this whole lifetime, similarly, you'll go into another body of death. In other words, you're already reincarnating. It's not a mystery. And as described here, okay, I can't remember when I was 1 year old. I can't remember when I was 6 months. I can't remember when I was 2 months in the womb. I don't remember. Does anyone remember those things? I mean, usually you start remembering about 4 or 5, you know, something like that. And then you can remember back then. But we certainly were there. Our parent, mother, you probably have pictures. You were doing stuff, right? So this is a very important thing. Everyone can understand that. No one can argue with it. So therefore, not remembering doesn't mean you weren't there. Similarly, you were before the womb. You had a life. Now, of course, you can't see that with the present science. But as we pointed out, there are instances where children remember some of that previous life, and it's confirmed. Yeah, okay. So reincarnation is a fact. Now that's, blows away the whole scientific idea of how life comes. You know, they really basically think that it starts with anew each time someone's born. Life comes into being. You know, where is it? I mean, is reincarnation now part of the curriculum in universities? No. But it's obviously true. So now, to the present, what Krishna is doing here, he's giving us an analogy, or taking us from what we know to what we don't know. This is what teaching is. So he's teaching Uddhava. Of course, Uddhava knows all this, but he's teaching us through Uddhava. So I don't know about each of you, but I remember the first time I was aware that someone died that I knew was my grandmother. I still remember that, you know, that it was a shock, because as children you're not aware of death, you know, and a certain time someone dies, and it's like it changes your whole view of what's going on here. Oh, I'll never see that person again. You know, what happened to them and so forth. It's like it's a shock. And yet, as Krishna's saying, okay, well, we can't understand that we're going to die, because we can't remember the last time. So how do we know? Well, we see everyone else die, and we see our own parents dying, or grandparents, or great-grandparents, right? It's obviously they're going. So therefore, it's not, you know, out of the realm of possibility. One can project oneself, yes, I'm getting older, and I'm also going to be like that. I'm also going to die one day. And similarly, you see your children, you see so many children taking birth. That's the other side. That's what happened. I can't remember it, but that must have happened. So it's a very simple point here. But what's the basic point, or the motive? What is the conclusion to all of this? The conclusion is that we want to get out of it. It's not a pleasant experience. You know, conditioned life is built on this forgetting. Maya is very expert at making you forget, or push into the background the things that are most important, the things that are most pressing, the things that are most painful. Like we have the, you know, hospitals and nursing homes and things, you know. And I think part of my, you know, waking up from, you know, the gross illusion was that I got a job in a hospital. This was back in the early 70s. And a hospital, you see, birth, death, old age, and disease is right there in front of you all the time. And even you can have a job in a hospital and be a clerk or an accountant or something and not see it. But I was going around to the wards. I was the inhalation therapist, you know, and I was giving people, they call it ambu bags. I don't know if they have them now. They're manual breathers until you get the machine on them. And so I saw people die. I saw young guys die from heart attacks, you know. I saw people who had you know, terminal illnesses. They were just suffering so much. It was just painful to see them, you know. And meanwhile, I was fortunate. I was reading the Bhagavad Gita, and I was seeing the reality of all of this, and understanding, you know, It's hard. You really have to be in gross illusion not to say, well, yeah, this is also going to happen to me. You know, this is going to happen to me. So that's, Krishna is waking us up here. And the end of the whole thing is that we should want to get out. We should want to solve, it's a problem. This is a problem, this birth and death and old age and disease. This is the main problem. And it doesn't do any good to put the main problem aside and just deal with the peripheral problems. This is also part of Maya's thing. Well, I can't do anything about those. This is the assumption. Therefore, I'll just worry about getting enough food, you know, a roof over my head, you know, a little entertainment, sex life, you know. That's the problems I can maybe do something about. These big problems I can't do anything about. That's the philosophy of the ostrich, you know. Stick your head in the sand. Look, the lion is 300 yards away. I've got a good 20 seconds, right? Well, let's live as much as we can. Stick my head in the sand. Forget about the lion. I got so many dreams. I can think of so many things in that 20 seconds. We'll worry about the future later. 10 seconds, 5 seconds. You know, this is actually material life. People think that they can't solve these problems because they have no understanding of the basic, you know, Bhagavad Gita philosophy, that there is a way of escaping birth and death, that there is a solution to these problems. So Krishna is not letting us get away. If you follow the practice of regular study of these books, you're constantly reminded of the reality. And the practice of Krishna consciousness gives you encouragement in your life that you can actually solve it and make your life, you know, make your life successful. And you can feel yourself giving up this identification of the self with the body. The more that we actually serve Krishna, we chant the holy name, you can feel that the powerful imprisonment, the sense of being trapped within the body and having to simply deal with life and everything else on that basis is given up. This whole movement is designed to loosen those ties and ultimately to break them entirely. Now, I wanted to share with you one thing, because the problem we have is Maya is so strong and the modes of nature are so strong that even though we may hear this every day and study, still, if we allow the senses to engage in sense gratification, we allow the mind to dwell on sense gratification, then we can forget everything, you know, at least for some time. We forget everything and dive back again into illusory activity. So I wanted to read something that I found very telling. And these are six prayers by Akrura. Now, Akrura has a very important role to play in Krishna Lila. Oops. He was Krishna's uncle. He lived in Mathura. And he took the role of taking a message from Mathura to Vrindavan as an agent of Kamsa to bring Krishna and Balaram back to Mathura, because, well, Krishna had been born there. Balaram actually appeared in Vrindavan. But anyway, to bring them to Mathura to engage in a wrestling match. So one could say, well, that's not very devotional. You know, he's engaging in activity on the behalf of a demon to try to kill Krishna. But we find that sometimes. Bhishma is on his side of Duryodhana, but he's actually a great devotee of Krishna. So he has a role to play, and he's known for his prayers. Akura is like the acharya for prayers. There's 9 different processes of devotional service. One of it is offering prayers. So his prayers appear in the Bhagavatam, mostly in chapter 40. And these are prayers that he's offering to Krishna as he's taking Krishna and Balaram to Mathura. They stop in the Yamuna, and Krishna and Balaram take a bath in the Yamuna and then get back on the chariot. And then Akura then also goes into the Yamuna and takes a bath. But when he's in the Yamuna, he sees Krishna and Balaram. He says, I thought you were back on the chariot. And so they go back to the chariot. And he says, what's going on? I just saw you in the Yamuna. He goes back in the Yamuna, and now he sees Sankushan and Ananta Shesh, who are expansions of Krishna. And he offers these prayers. So I'm going to share these with you, and they deal exactly with this subject matter, which is someone, in this case, he takes the role of a conditioned soul, and he's realizing his imprisonment, you know, his condition. But then he says, "But and even though I realize it, I don't have the strength to do anything about it." But then there's a solution at the end, what he does. So the first verse is like this. Bhagavan jiva lokoyam mohitas tavamaya aham mamed asad graho brahmite karma vartmasu. O Supreme Lord, the living entities in this world are bewildered by your illusory energy. That's maya, tavamaya. And because of that, aham mameti asagraho, they have the philosophy that I am this body and everything in relation to it is mine. This is called aham mameti, a conclusion that I am the body and everything. This is called false ego. And therefore they adopt all kinds of false philosophies. Asagraha. Agraha means to grasp. The way in which we have the word grasp also means to understand. Oh, I grasp what you're saying, right? We say that. So in Sanskrit, the same thing is there. A philosophy can also be called a graha, a way in which you understand yourself and the world. But these are asagraha. On the basis of I and mine, all kinds of false philosophies are propagated and we accept them. And in that condition, brahmite karma vartmasu, they wander on the paths of karma, of fruit of activity. Now he's saying this is about the people in general, jiva loka, but now he says, I'm also like that. He's saying, aham chatmatma jagada darada svajanadishu bhamami swapna kalpeshu mudha satyadiyavibo. So he says, I'm also in that condition of illusion, identifying as my own, my body, my home, my wife, my money, my swajana, my relatives and children and everything. I'm thinking, brahmami, swapna kalpeshu, although they have the quality of a dream. Now, if you review what we've just read the last couple of weeks, you see that Krishna keeps bringing that up, the dreamlike quality of this world, of the fact that all of our material life is just like a dream. So he said, they have the quality of a dream, but still, muda, this fool, satyadiya, I'm thinking they're real. I'm thinking they're true. Everything is true. Oh, Lord. And then this verse, which for me just struck me so much when I first read it, anityanatma dukhe shuva parya matirya ham dvandvaramo tamo vishto dvandvaramas tamo vishto najane tvatmanakpriyam. Everything is backwards. My whole conception of life is upside down. I'm through the looking glass. I'm in the upside down banyan tree in chapter 15 of the Bhagavad Gita. So that means that which is temporary, anitya, I'm taking to be permanent. My living conditions, my body, all of my relationships, right, live happily ever after. Anatma, that which I'm not, the body, I'm taking to be me. And dukeshu, the sources of misery, I'm taking to be sources of pleasure, just as Krishna says in the fifth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. This is viparya matir. This is a backwards mentality, reversed. And in this reversed illusory condition, dvandvaramo, I'm trying to enjoy the dualities of this world. Tamo vishto, I'm entering further and further into illusion and darkness. And najane tvatpanak priyam, I do not understand that you are my dearmost master and lord and friend. Carlos, you may have to stand up or sit in a chair. Okay. If you fall asleep. Okay. Hare Krishna. So then he compares himself like a fool who yadabodo jalam hitva padi channam tarud bhavai abbeti magatishtam vai tadvat faham paranuka. This idea of turning away one's face from Krishna. This is mentioned here. Paran mukha. Mukha is the face. This is what we've done. This is the original sin. This is why we're here. We turned away, we turned our back on Krishna, and we turned our face toward the illusory energy, and we begin in the embrace of Maya Shakti for millions of births. So, just like a fool, there's a pool of water. Imagine there's a desert, and in the desert, there's an oasis. And in the oasis, there's a little pool of water right next to the edge of the oasis. You're standing by that pool of water. You're thirsty, right? But you can't see the pool. Why? Because of the grass and the growth, whatever greens have grown up from that water. Sometimes it's so much foliage that it practically covers the water. So that's a tamudra. This material world has grown up from Krishna. It's Krishna's. But because of it, we can't see Krishna. Because we want to try to enjoy it. We don't see Krishna in the material world. We see his external energy and we're covered. So exactly like that. So now this thirsty person, he's looking for water, looking for water. Where's the water? I can't see the water. Looks out in the desert. There's the mirage. Runs out into the desert and finds nothing. Death, you see. So that's what he compares himself to. And we keep running, you know, after those mirages. This, the dream, the phantasmagoria. So now comes this statement. Okay, so he's had four verses in which he's nicely outlined material mentality, material condition. But now he's saying that in spite of this, notse yam kripanadhi, kama karma hatam mana rodham bamati bishchakshur riyamanamitastadaha. My intelligence, even though I understand this, my intelligence is so crippled that I cannot find the strength to curb my mind, which is disturbed by material desires and activities and constantly being dragged here and there by the obstinate senses. This is exactly where we're at. We understand the philosophy, but if you don't undergo the practices properly for disciplining the mind and the senses, then you'll find those very, very powerful mind, senses, and even lusty intelligence taking you away. And it's kind of a tragic condition. It's like Arjuna. Arjuna knew the right thing to do, but his heart, you know, he was taking the role of a conditioned soul. He was overwhelmed by miserly weakness. So he's doing the right, he did the right thing, and the same thing happens here with Akrura. You have to really throw yourself at the mercy of the spiritual master and beg to be instructed, and so that you can get the strength to control your mind. So that's the last verse here that I'm going to read. Soham tavanga bhagatos masatam dorapam tachapyaham bhavadanugri ishamanye. Pung so bhavedya hi sang sadanapabhargas tvayab janava sadapasani amatisya. Being thus fallen. So now what's the solution, right? This is a critical point. This is like the either-or point. Anyone ever read Kierkegaard? You know, either-or. Are you going to surrender to Jesus, or are you going to surrender to mammon? You know, that's really... So then you have to take the leap. It's like all of you taking the leap, join the Hare Krishnas. Otherwise, you're going to be overwhelmed out there. So being thus fallen, I'm approaching your feet for shelter, O Lord, because although the impure can never attain your feet, I think it is nevertheless possible by your mercy. Only when one's material life has ceased, O Lord, can one develop consciousness of you by serving your pure devotees. So the idea here is that in our condition, if we're fortunate souls, we get a book, you know, we could become exposed to the philosophy and we understand it. But that's not enough. We have to actually take up the process of yoga, bhakti yoga, by which we can control the mind. And that process is delivered to us daily, you know, by the mercy of our spiritual masters. Actually, it says pure devotees here. So this is how we can attain that strength to control the mind, is by really establishing relationship, because ultimately... We act on the basis of personal relationships. You know, just think of like a mother, you know. You see, you know, a mother walking. That mother is absorbed. Whatever children she has, you know, that's where the consciousness is. If she gets a phone call, a kid is sick and or has an accident, boom, out she goes, you know. This is what causes. And she may be doing so many things, eating or, you know, at work. I'm gone. That's the most important thing. It's the relationships. So we need to establish a strong relationship with our spiritual masters and really take them as our ultimate pramana, our ultimate inspiration for activity. For activity and what to do and what not to do. Now, how do we relate to Srila Prabhupada? The most important way, through his words, through his books. When we read a verse from the Bhagavad Gita, or we read a verse, this verse here, this is also Prabhupada speaking. I mean, he has said similar things so many times. The philosophy is one. So we should feel that, you know, Krishna is speaking to Uddhava, but it's also Prabhupada speaking, and also those of us who are, you know, develop relations with our own spiritual master, the same message is coming there. In this canto, I don't know if we've come to it yet, there's a very nice explanation of Guru Tattva, which Srila Prabhupada echoes in this wonderful address, which I highly recommend you read. Maybe we'll make it available. It's in the Vedabase. Prabhupada gave this address in 1935, I think it was, on his Guru Maharaj's appearance day, Vyasa Puja. And he talks about this principle of Guru, how Guru is one. Guru is one. Guru is Krishna. Krishna is the original Guru. But he appears in many forms through, you know, our own personal Guru, or our own personal instructing Gurus and initiating Gurus like that. But the principle of Guru is one. In other words, an actual spiritual master cannot deviate from what Krishna says. He has to provide the same message in a way that can be understood. The main thing that Prabhupada did, you know, I consider anyway, was to translate, to make it into English. What good is it to us if it's all in Bengali and Sanskrit? To make these things available in English, and he even, you know, prayed to Krishna. I know my English isn't that perfect, you know, but he took inspiration from the verse in Bhagavatam, Tad Bhagavasargoja. Even if imperfectly composed, if the message is pure, then it's accepted by great souls and it can bring about a revolution in this society. So he did that. So, and you know, the lounge, the paper, somehow or other, present the philosophy in such a way that it attracts the imagination and the intelligence of the people who are going to be exposed to it. The language is important, not just the, you know, the tongue, the English or what, but what kind of English. It's not old English, you know, it's modern English, all these things. So that relationship, and when we feel that, oh yes, I have a responsibility to this person to do this, to get up in the morning and chant my rounds. Because we're not spontaneous. We have to accept that sense of duty, of austerity. So why would you do that? Because someone wants you to. You know, we read about the early days of ISKCON. Amazing things. Of course, they're still happening today. You know, we heard last night, those who were at that nice program with Bidvasi. You know, he went traveling and he got arrested. They were going to the execution at dawn in Africa. Africa's like, you know, the jungles, you know. And he was chanting. You can imagine. Just try to project yourself. You're chanting now in the middle of the night. He said he couldn't sleep naturally. You know, this could be your last night. How intensely you would chant. No spacing out on those rounds. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. You know. But he undertook that. You know, what impelled him to do that? His relationship with Prabhupada, with the spiritual master, with Krishna. So that's how we can get the strength to curb the mad mind, is by feeling that, okay, I do really want to do this, but I know that this is not going to be pleasing to my spiritual master, so I'm not going to do it. I really don't want to do this, but I know it is going to be very pleasing to my spiritual master, therefore I'll do it. And that's how this movement grew, and that's how this movement is sustained to this very day. By devotees taking on those, you know, that austerities and, you know, sacrifices at the behest of persons whom they respect and love and who they know respect them and love them. And that's how you make advancement. Then before you know it, lo and behold, you're in bliss. you just, you know, you did some sacrifice, you know, and what's the fruit? Well, you didn't make any money. It's the same prasadam is there. The same deities are there, the same mantras are there, the same books are there, but everything is sweeter. You know, the deities seem to be smiling more at you than ever before, you know, you're relishing their beauty, the holy name is so sweet, the kirtans, you don't want to stop, because that's the fruit. That's the actual result, the only result we should pray for. More and more attraction to Krishna. So I'll end with that, with one nice poem in that, to that regard. These are the prayers. You know, how does Rupa Goswami pray? Now, here's one sample. We know some of Lord Chaitanya's prayer. Pasanga, no, sorry, not Pasanga. Bhujanga de Pachandaka, Spuddha de Changa, Chudankare, Dhyananka Shatragunchala, Brahminda Bhattam, Ringam Brahme, Patanga de Hutastati, Bhanakati, the Kavi Priye, Padaspuddha de Me, Mahustwai Mukunda, Shuddha Rati. Who can guess what Shuddha Rati means? Did you go?
Pure attraction.
Yeah, pure attraction and pure love. He's praying for pure love. So he says, he's painting a picture. You wear the best of crests, a crown of perfect peacock plumes. Your dancing glances stun the bees meandering midst the blooms. You relish love play in the cottage by Kalindi's shore. O Krishna, may pure love for you be mine forevermore. We can pray like that. You can pray like that to Krishna. I'll give you the prayer if you want. Any questions, comments on these prayers of Krishna? All right. You're not going to get away. Yes, go ahead.
I wondered which canto is that you refer to about
the prayers of Krishna? These are the prayers of Akura. They're in Canto 10. Let me get the exact reference for you. Canto 10, Chapter 40, beginning in text 23. 10, 40, 23. That's where I began reading. I read six verses. And just let me read the translation once more to the verse we read today. 22, 48. Okay, we're almost at the end of this chapter. 49. By the death of one's father or grandfather, one can surmise one's own death, and by the birth of one's son, one can understand the condition of one's own birth. A person who thus realistically understands the creation and destruction of material bodies is no longer subject to these dualities. So the key phrase is realistically understands. How do we get to that point? Thank you. Oh, yes, Peru.
Right.
Well, you can't. You know, the average Joe. Is this Joe Sixpack? Because I think that's probably that. the point is that, you know, that's not how to approach Joe like that. You need to approach in such a way that he's intrigued or interested in some way, like. You know, Vijay Prabhu, he writes out these nice vignettes from Sankirtan. So this one fellow was describing how, you know, where is he preaching? In India. You know, he's preaching. And an older fellow. And you're going to encounter Muslims, you know. So he doesn't shy away. He's trying to sell him a book. So, this is interesting. So the Muslims... He said, I'm not interested in your book, but I'm a Muslim. I'm going to be interested in your book. But because the way you're presenting it is so sweet and gentle, I'm going to buy your book. Another fellow, he said, I'm not interested, you know. He says, okay, it's okay, but just look at the quality of the book. You know, so he was interested in the quality. He saw the paintings, and on the basis of the paintings, he was buying the book. So the art of preaching is finding that point of interest. For a lot of people, it may be, you know, prasadam, you know. I mean, a lot of these restaurants are wonderful ways in which people interact with us, you know, because they're, we can eat, you know, it's very nice. And there's the book there. The devotees are nice. Music is nice. Prasadam, the food is nice. Maybe the book is nice. Let me look at the, you know. So the art is presenting a philosophy in such a way that no one will reject it out of hand. You know, but certainly they're not going to be able to relate to that. You know that there's a solution. That's why they put it in the background. Well, that's inevitable, and therefore let's deal with some other problems that we can deal with. You know, but that's the main problem. You know, and in fact, you can't deal with any of the other problems either. Those solutions that you make, the material solutions you make to your material problems, are the source of your further material problems. I want a house. Okay, let me take out a mortgage. I got the house. I can't pay the mortgage. Now I got more. You know, 100 million people in America are threatened with homelessness or whatever. You know. All glory to Srila Prabhupada.